This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to talk to Maurice Hinchey, who's a congressman from the state of New York. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Well, thank you, Mark.
We're going to talk specifically about the content of a press conference you had today, in which you criticized various specific people and the agency itself over at the FDA for some conflicts of interest. Why don't you give us sort of a brief synopsis of what the problem is over there as you see it?
Well, the problem, the center of the problem, at least, seems to lie in the chief counsel's office. The chief counsel was appointed in August of 2001, and in a very unusual way. Normally, chief counsel at FDA would be someone who was a professional, someone who had worked in that office or worked in the agency for some period of time.
What people call career civil servants.
Career civil servants, yeah.
Right.
Someone who approaches it from a professional, detached point of view. But the Bush administration, for whatever reason, decided that they would reach out to the private sector, and they appointed a lawyer. The lawyer had previously worked...
By the name of... What's the name of this person here?
The lawyer's name is... Troy.
Right.
T-R-O-Y.
Okay.
And
He hadn't just been in the private sector. He'd been in a particular part of the private sector before.
That's right. He was in a law firm.
Right.
He was in a law firm, and the law firm is Wiley Ryan.
Right.
They worked for Pfizer. And he went from there over to the... counsel's office and the FDA. So, in other words, he had previously worked for the pharmaceutical industry. He
right.
represented the pharmaceutical industry, represented Pfizer particularly, and in the 3 years prior to his appointment at FDA, his law firm had been paid $415,000 for services that were provided directly by Mr. Troy.
Okay, now to put this in context, this probably isn't the only example of the Bush administration appointing people to sensitive policymaking roles who had previously been in the industries and companies that are determined to that ought to be regulated by their agencies that they're now in, is it?
Well, that's my experience, yes.
Right.
There are a number of examples where this administration has appointed people to regulatory agencies, and those people come out of the environment that is being regulated.
Right. Now, that presumably gives them a knowledge about the jargon and the issues and the terms of discussion on those issues, but in your opinion, does it give them too much of a bias as a sort of as a general proposition to be good government officials after that?
I think in most cases, it turns out in experience that these individuals bring with them a bias toward the part of the economy from which they have came or which they represented.
Right.
And they tend to act in concert with those folks who were their previous clients and to aid them and abet them in whatever way that they can.
Okay, why don't you give some specific examples of how you think this happened over at the FDA?
Okay.
With Mr. Troy.
In July of 2002, Malcolm Wheeler, who was an attorney at Pfizer, called Mr. Troy. He's now in the office of the chief counsel.
Right.
And requested that Mr. Troy get involved in a private state lawsuit against Pfizer that was ongoing in California. Mr. Troy obliged him, and in September, less than 2 months later, the FDA, through the Department of Justice, filed a court brief in support of Pfizer. And, of course, Pfizer was... one of the principal companies that retained Mr. Troy's law firm.
Now, apart from that, is it typical behavior for a regulatory agency to file was it an amicus brief?
It was a brief that was solicited by the entity that was being sued.
Right.
Now, it happens from time to time that courts will turn to the FDA, and
right.
the court will ask the FDA on the basis of their judgment, experience, and opinion, what they think about a particular issue. That happens from time to time, and of course that's perfectly appropriate. But in this particular case, there was no solicitation from the court. The solicitation came from the entity being sued, the company
right.
being sued, Pfizer.
So essentially, Pfizer One official at Pfizer asked an official, formerly the lawyer for Pfizer, now in the FDA, to weigh in on their behalf in a matter of pending litigation.
That's precisely correct.
And they agreed to and did.
They agreed to and did.
And what was the result? In the case?
The result is still not clear.
Okay. You mean the case hasn't been decided yet?
I don't know that it has, right?
Oh, okay. All right. Now,
there's another example I could give you. That same July, Mr. Troy had a meeting with Michelle Koresh from Morrison and Forrester. Morrison and Forrester is one of the largest firms in the country. It's based in California. At the time of this meeting between Mr. Troy and Michelle Koresh, the law firm was representing GlaxoSmithKline in a private lawsuit in California that revolved around California's Proposition 65, or as it is sometimes known, the Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act.
Right.
Michelle Koresh was, at that time, the lead attorney for GlaxoSmithKline. And on September 12, less than 2 months after that meeting, Mr. Troy's FDA filed a brief in support of Ms. Koresh's client, GlaxoSmithKline.
Right.
This is a pattern that that continues on. Another example, on December 12th of 2003, the FDA filed a statement of interest in the case involving Murphy v. Pacesetter. This is statement that they filed in support of the medical device manufacturer Pacesetter.
Okay.
The company at that time was being sued in the state of Tennessee, and it was being sued for a faulty pacemaker. We uncovered a letter that was written to FDA, dated November 25, 2003, from the law firm of Feldman, Gale, and Weber, directing FDA on how it should assist its case.
Right.
The case was Murphy versus Pacesetter, and the firm was representing Pacesetter.
Sounds a little like the tail wagging the dog if the private law firms are telling the government regulatory agency what they should say.
Well, yes, that's true, but it's even worse than that. The
okay.
private, the regulatory agency is supposed to be detached and is supposed to be involving itself, when it does involve itself, on behalf of the general public.
Now, in your research into this, have you found that Mr. Troy, Mr. Daniel Troy, who we've been talking about, has essentially been doing this on his own, or has he been, I don't want to use the word colluding, has he been cooperating with other people in the counsel's office? What's his position over there at the FDA that gives him the ability to essentially bring the FDA as such into play in these cases?
Well, he's the chief counsel.
He's not just in the office of the chief counsel. He is the chief counsel.
He is the chief counsel, and so he calls the shots over there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, and I assume you've got a few other incidents like this in similar cases? Is that pretty much it?
No, there's some other things.
Okay. Well, we'll let people, we're going to put a link to the some other press materials that lead to other links and things on your site and so on for people to get more details if they want it. But
well, he did something very unusual.
Okay.
In addition to the other unusual things, but this thing really is very odd.
Okay.
He published, that is the chief counsel, Troy, published in the Federal Register.
Right, which for people who don't know is the official house organ of the federal government.
That's right, where all of the federal activities and actions take place, and where people who are interested in what's going on with regulatory agencies, how they're being regulated, things of that nature.
And the final step, really, of any regulation or law or whatever is to appear in the Federal Register.
That's right. It appears there. That's correct. That's the final.
In the old days, they would ink a parchment, and the town crier would come out and read it to the assembled townspeople, and now it's published in the Federal Register.
That's correct.
Okay.
Where only those people who are intimately involved with the proceedings are likely to read it.
That's right.
But that's the way it is. At the Federal Register, and in that register, Mr. Troy published a notice, interestingly enough, questioning whether FDA's regulations complied with the First Amendment.
Right.
Now, this is interesting because a notice like that would be certainly used against the FDA in lawsuits. People would just raise that and say, well, Your Honor, here we have the chief counsel of the FDA himself questioning whether its own regulations comply with the First Amendment of the Constitution.
I don't want to get too deeply into it, but which provisions of the First Amendment were supposedly being violated?
Well, I don't have that.
The only one that comes to mind is freedom of speech.
Yeah, well, that's what it is, basically.
Right.
It comes down to the First Amendment has to do with basic essential freedoms.
It sounds
freedom
a little
of speech
bit
would be the one that would be involved here, unquestionably,
right.
But I don't have the the document in front of me.
Okay, it sounds to me on the same the way you explain it on the same level or tone as the head of the IRS publishing a notice saying that the income tax is unconstitutional.
Yeah, right. That's about the same level. So when we saw that, we asked the Congressional Research Service to see if there was any precedent for anything like this happening. And they looked at it, and here's what they came back to us and said. They said, we were not able to uncover any similar instance where a federal agency issued a notice seeking the type of public comment on a constitutional issue and regulatory issue such as this particular one.
Now, has that had any fallout in court since then? Have people been using it as an argument in favor of their own position and against regulation?
We don't know. It may be. There are a lot of proceedings taking place in a lot of courts around, and so no one has come to our attention yet, but it's very likely.
Okay, so you've made some case here that Mr. Troy is looking out for the interests of the drug companies and not for the interests of the people that the FDA is supposed to be protecting. What's your recommendation? Are you saying that he should resign?
I'm saying that this is something that we ought to be paying attention to. I don't know if he should resign, but he's certainly not doing his job. He's shutting down avenues that are used to expose fraud in the drug agency, and he's making it easier for drug companies to produce, for example, misleading advertisements.
Yes, we'll talk about that, speaking of freedom of speech. I just saw two new ones new to me anyway, two new commercials just this afternoon. One has probably been around for a while, and it's talking about essentially a non-stimulant ADD treatment for kids. Mm-hmm. But the other one was far more interesting. It had that little blob from the Zoloft commercials, who in the past had only been depressed and was being cheered up after it took Zoloft. But this has the little blob and a whole group of half a dozen or more little blobs who are all happily dancing to some vaguely rhythmic event. And the poor little blob, back again, I guess he's off his meds because he's looking longingly at the little blobs that are dancing around happily, and it turns out he has social anxiety disorder. And after he gets his infusion of Zoloft, he has a little smile, and you can see that he'll be dating a lot pretty soon. And I thought this was kind of insidious.
Wow.
Especially because a few years ago there was no such thing as social anxiety disorder, but it's apparently been created by the drug companies. Is that some of what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's some of it, exactly what we're talking about. And we had some people today at the press conference with us, several families, who have experienced something very tragic in their lives, and that is the suicide of a member of their family after taking some of the antidepressants, like the ones that you were just describing.
Right.
And the fact that these antidepressants are not being described accurately, the fact that the trials that are run by the drug companies are not being carried out honestly, the fact that information that is revealed in these trials that are indicative of problems with these various drugs and the conditions that they may bring about in people and disorders, personality disorders that may result, all of that is kept quiet.
You mean they do?
It's hidden.
Right. You mean they finance drug studies on their drugs, and if there's a good positive results that shows that they're safe and effective, they make sure it's published and publicized, and if it's got a bad result, they bury it?
That's correct.
Ah, I see.
And so one of the things that we're trying to do is to establish a national registry where all of these trials will be published in complete and exact detail.
And that would, of course, be published essentially before they're begun,
yes,
wouldn't it be?
That would be published before their sales begin.
Well, I think I saw that some of the drug companies have apparently said it's okay to have a registry of the studies after they're done, but it would seem to me that the important thing would be, and also other people have said this, to register the trials as they begin, before there are any results at all, so that people will know that they exist, and if they have a good result, good, and if they have a bad result, that needs to be known also, but there'll be no way to hide the fact that the study, well, I'm sure there will become new ways to hide the fact, but it would be harder to hide the fact that a study had been commenced and had gone to created results that show that the drugs are either ineffective or dangerous or both, mm-hmm, and that that fact, those facts would have to be publicized just as widely.
Sure, that's exactly right.
So is there legislation pending to do that on the federal level? Or?
There is legislation that we are introducing, yes, which is pending.
Okay.
Let me give you another example, which just you just brought to mind when
right.
you were talking about that kind of thing and about advertising. There is a, within the FDA, there's a division of drug marketing, advertising, and communication.
Right.
It's a very small division. It consists only of 7 people. Nevertheless, it's responsible for reviewing the accuracy of prescription drug consumer-directed advertisements.
Which is 7 people is less than the people, the support staff at one advertising agency for one drug company's one drug.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So they're always outnumbered, always outgunned, apparently.
Right. But these people, apparently, they're serious about their work.
Right.
And they're doing it aggressively. Last year, these 7 people reviewed 38,400 ads.
And they're hardworking.
So they're doing a lot of reviewing, and they are referring their reviews and the results of their reviews to the enforcement actions within the FDA. And it's something interesting happened last year. So despite this increase of 6% up to 38,400 reviews of these ads,
right,
the number of enforcement letters sent out by FDA to drug manufacturers for false and misleading advertisements dropped 75%.
Hmm.
Isn't that odd? Now, that's the way we thought. It was very, very odd. So
right,
we looked into it, and we found that the reason for the drop was not that the drug company suddenly cleaned up their act. It was that all public information that we could get, in fact, indicates the contrary. But why the drop? The real reason for the drop is a conscious effort on the part of the FDA to weaken advertising regulations. Shortly after this administration took office, the FDA's chief counsel instituted a policy that all advertising warning labels must go through his office. Prior to this, all the letters were sent from the division of drug marketing right out to enforcement. But
right,
he now has intervened.
Is that the same Daniel Troy?
Same Daniel Troy.
Okay.
And now the number of enforcement letters has dropped by 75% because he's cut them off, apparently.
Okay. Well, there are 2 things I'd like to comment on and get your reaction to. Essentially, then, if his job is to look out for the interests of the drug companies at FDA, he's doing a good job, wouldn't you say? If that's his job.
If that were his job,
one
would have to congratulate him on it.
Because
his real job
right,
is to look out for the public.
Well, then, what part of the government is responsible for calling him to task and ordering him to change his priorities, if any?
Well, the executive branch, of course, is the part of the government for which he works.
Right.
So the executive branch should call him to task.
Who does he... say a little bit about the sort of employment position of people in these regulatory agencies. They're appointed by the president and at a high enough level, I suppose, they need Senate approval. But do they answer to anyone? Can the president say, I want you removed and get it?
Oh, yeah.
However independent they are, they're subject to they serve at the pleasure of the president. Is that?
That's correct.
That
they're
right?
appointed by the president. Mr.
Right.
Troy is appointed by the president and serves at the pleasure of the president. The president could remove him immediately.
So,
if the president weren't interested in doing that, if we had a government here in Washington where the normal checks and balances were being carried out
right,
with some degree of efficiency, the Congress would be looking into this and conducting a hearing and an investigation and producing the results that I have found, and they would simply call for his resignation.
Right. No, I haven't asked.
We have a monolithic government here in Washington,
right,
where the leadership of both houses of the Congress is in virtual servitude to the administration. And so there is no longer that balance of power.
So this is really
no longer checks and balances.
So this, which the speaking of the Constitution, is pretty much the fundamental principle of the Constitution,
exactly,
which is checks and balances.
Yeah.
So what a few weeks ago, I guess I saw a Fahrenheit 9/11, which makes the argument that the Bush family is pretty much does the same thing for the oil companies that you say Mr. Troy is doing for the drug companies. It seems like the standard pattern.
Yeah, well, it is a standard pattern with this administration. I don't think there's any question about that. And as I say, because you have what I refer to as a monolithic government,
right,
you have the Congress exercising its constitutional responsibilities to oversee the executive branch and make sure that it's operating in a way that is in the public interest, but they close their eyes to it here. So those of us who are Democrats here in the minority in both the House and the Senate are trying to get attention for these this kind of behavior and doing the things that we can. For example, I offered an amendment today which cuts $500,000 out of the FDA counsel's office and puts it over where those seven people are working so hard to review those cases.
What kind of reception did the amendment get?
Well, because I was able to, in the context of offering the amendment, because I was able to detail the kind of conflicts of interest in which the chief counsel's office has engaged itself and the way in which the FDA is operating in ways contrary to the public interest, and talk about that on the floor of the House of Representatives, the opposition did not want to debate the amendment, and so it passed on a voice vote.
Oh, okay. Now, I'm tempted to compare or ask you the difference between a monolithic government and a one-party state.
About the same thing.
But from what you just said, though, whatever it's called, there is some leeway here that you can sort of embarrass the Republicans into not stopping slightly minor adjustments in view of all of the really big problems that are going on. Would that be fair to say?
I think that would be fair to say, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take every opportunity we can to demonstrate how this government is malfunctioning.
But if you're able to, through a press conference and embarrassing the Republicans to a certain extent, get $500,000 transferred, but Mr. Troy, if he is, as you allege, essentially the instrument of the drug companies, is able to institute and maintain policies that make them a marginal increases of billions of dollars, much of which will be funneled back into contributions to mostly, I assume, Republican candidates for Congress and Senate, mm-hmm. and the Republican candidate for president, who then gives them a good return on their investment of hundreds of thousands of dollars of campaign funds by turning around and making regulations and maintaining regulations that allow them to make billions of dollars more. It's kind of a, I don't call it a money laundering scheme, but I don't see exactly how it differs.
Well, it is a money laundering scheme, and that's exactly what's going on here. Yeah, the drug companies are one of the principal contributors to George H.W. Bush, and to other Republicans. And the reason for that is the Republican Party, the National Republican Party, has configured itself in such a way as to be the protector and apologist for these corporations, like energy companies and pharmaceutical companies, that bilk and defraud the public in ways that are often very dangerous. I mentioned the fact that today we had three families that talked about members of their families who had committed suicide. And they committed suicide after they were taking these antidepressants. And there seems to be a causal relationship between the two.
Right.
These things need to be investigated very, very carefully. The trials need to be honest and straightforward. The drug companies cannot be allowed to hide information that comes out in the context of their examination of the impact of their drugs on the people who take it. And the Food and Drug Administration, which is an entity that has been set up by the federal government to protect the public against abuses from drug companies and the manufacturers of medical equipment, and to make sure that those pharmaceuticals and the medical equipment function in the way that they are supposed to, that FDA has abandoned its responsibility and now is more of a mouthpiece for the entities it is supposed to be regulating.
Okay, let me make this point one more time and then tell you a possible vision here and then get any final comments you want to make. I've interviewed Karen Barth Menzies of Baum Hedlund several times. She's representing Kim Witzak, whose husband Woody committed suicide after being treated with an antidepressant for a few weeks. And she's also the lead attorney in a case against GlaxoSmithKline for addicting people to Paxil. Of course, there was a little note in the Zoloft commercial that I saw this afternoon saying, Zoloft does not have it for me. And and in any case, she is and has admitted to me on the air that she's a trial lawyer. And she's there to provide redress for the many clients in the Paxil suit and for Ms. Witzak in the case involving her late husband. And she's arguing against the corporations. And the Republican National ticket is making much of the fact that John Edwards, the Democratic vice presidential presumptive nominee, is a trial lawyer who in fact looks out at trials for the interests of people who've been allegedly abused by corporations. And mm-hmm. so it sort of comes full circle. And the same conflicts and alliances seem to obtain throughout the entire political, medical, social fabric of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the Bush administration says that there's something wrong with trial lawyers, what they mean by that is we want to do whatever we can to make sure that the ordinary American citizen does not have an opportunity to get his or her day in court when they have been abused by corporations.
In fact, what they mean, they don't like plaintiff's lawyers.
That's right. They don't like plaintiff's lawyers. They don't like people to have access to the courts. They don't want the ordinary man and woman, the ordinary blue-collar, white-collar working people of this country who are abused repeatedly by pharmaceutical companies because of misinformation, because of the marketing of materials that really don't deserve to be on the market, because of pace setters in one case that I mentioned earlier today, because of the oil companies, the way they built billions of dollars from people in California last year. The Bush administration wants to cut off access to the courts, which is the place of last resort for American citizens. When you have an administration like this one that corrupts the regulatory agencies, as this FDA has been, the last place you can go is to the courts.
It's interesting that you say cut off access to the courts, because it would seem to be a different context, but in fact the Guantanamo cases have directly involved the Justice Department and the White House trying to cut off access to the courts of those particular accused.
That's right.
So that there's a sort of government-wide effort there, as you were saying, to cut off access.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to change the government we have from a democratic republic to a dictatorship. And that's the direction in which they're moving. If they get away with it, then God bless all of us.
Because essentially what you're saying is that the same efforts that are being made to cut off access to the courts and make sure that the drug companies get what they want and the oil companies get what they want fit in pretty well, are exactly complementary to, in fact, the efforts at the government, the procedural and personnel level to put people into positions of power where they can look out for those interests and implement those policies that favor those interests.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which is what we have here, essentially.
Yeah, that's correct. It's all part of a pattern, and it's revealing of the psychology of this administration.
I don't want to dredge up ancient history, but there are some people who believe that this administration was not entitled to be the administration because the other side got more popular votes by everyone's admission, and had the irregularities in Florida been fully examined, would have had the Democrats would have had more electoral votes as well.
Mm-hmm. No, there's no question about that. George Bush did not win the election. He stole the election, and he was appointed by one Supreme Court justice in a 5-4 decision.
Right.
So that's the reason why we are afflicted as a society, as a country now, by this administration and the people like Mr. Troy that they have put into positions of responsibility.
What seems ironic to me, though, is that if the Republican control of the Congress and of the White House and of the regulatory agencies becomes even more complete, then people will be faced with a situation where they're not able to really protest or change the government, at which point they'll get political anxiety, and they'll decide they need Zoloft or Paxil or Prozac to make them feel better, because there's certainly nothing they can do in the political realm, which will give more billions of dollars to the drug companies, which will give more millions of dollars to the Republicans, which will enforce policies that will make people even crazier and make them take more drugs. You get a kind of feedback loop here in which you'll end up with a few people with all the money and everybody else on drugs and just sort of wandering around until some external force comes to topple the whole thing over.
Yeah. Well,
I call that the pharma state.
The pharma state, yeah. Well, you could see it happening. It's certainly not out of the realm of possibility.
Well, let's assume we don't want that. What kind of strategy are Democrats in the House and elsewhere talking about to avoid this particular outcome?
Well, we're doing everything that we can to reveal what is going on here in Washington, both in the Congress and in the administration. And we're doing it in whatever way we can. As a result of the press conference that I held today, subsequently this afternoon, I offered this amendment on the floor of the House for another opportunity to discuss these issues in a public way. And the way that the Republican Party here in the House of Representatives has restricted the debate on important issues, you have to be very creative and take every opportunity you can to get these issues out on the floor.
It's not exactly not exactly guerrilla warfare with you people as the insurgents, but it sounds close.
That's pretty close, yeah.
And that's why they called Newt Gingrich a bomb thrower, I guess, when he was out of power anyway.
Yeah, I suppose.
All right, well, I'm thoroughly depressed by the whole possibility here, and from my conversations with people in the House, you're absolutely right, and you're much more deeply involved with it than I am, so you'd know even better, but it just sounds, over in the Senate, there seems to be still a little bit of opportunity for the Democrats to do things, because it's close in the vote,
right.
and because the rules of the Senate are such, really, to give more power to individual senators and so on. But over in the House, with a slight, even with just the slight majority that's there, it's sort of like it's like with Bush, he allegedly got a few more votes, therefore he gets to be completely president. And over in the House, the Republicans have a few more members, therefore they get to run the whole thing.
Well, the rules of the House, the way that they have configured them and twisted them, give them a kind of supreme authority.
And right.
They're able to restrict the debate here very, very substantially, and that's why we have to be creative, as I've said, to try to get these issues out for exposure. And, you know, there are problems with the media, too. You have Fox Network, which is sort of the Al Jazeera of the United States.
There was a Democratic fundraiser in New York a few days ago. I didn't see much about it. Then I turned on Fox, and they were like, they had these people out there in the Capitol screaming, you know, about how the Democrats were just using bad words and doing this and bad things, and it's really pretty crazy, I thought.
Well, yeah, they have an agenda. Fox has an agenda. It's the agenda of the ex-Australian Rupert Murdoch.
Right.
It's a very right-wing agenda, and they're trying to get that agenda forced down the throat of the American people.
Well, say something about media concentration, because obviously there are just about the same number of big media outlets as there are big drug companies, with roughly the same results, I would guess, although, and it's hard to say whether what you put in your mouth that changes your brain chemistry is more important than what you put in through your eyes that changes your brain chemistry.
Or your ears.
They're both very important conduits, of because you can only act on the basis of what you see and hear and see and hear. And if that's all shut off, then things could be, you don't know how to operate, that seems to me.
Well, that's right. The American people get their information from newspapers, radio, and television. And increasingly, they get it from radio and television, and mostly from television. Because
right.
Increasingly, American people do not read newspapers or much else, for that matter, a
right.
lot of them.
Right.
That's an unfortunate situation. But it's one that has been capitalized on by the Republican Party. Going back to the Reagan administration in 1987, the Federal Communications Commission under then-President Reagan and subsequently under President George W. Bush began the process of consolidating the media. They did so by changing the rules of the FCC and getting certain things adopted by the Congress, which provide for companies, corporations, owning more and more radio and television stations.
Right, more around the whole country, more in any city, and cross-ownership of newspapers that the few people still read and the radio and television stations.
Precisely, so that it gives one corporation in a media market the ability to control all the information that goes out there, to censor things that they don't want people to hear or see, and to afflict them with the kinds of information that they think would be better for them, even if the information that they're giving out is not true.
Or at least
frequently it is if you watch Fox.
Right, or at least which they think would be better for the people putting out the information, even if it's, I don't think the interest of what's in the best interest of the people getting the information is really a concern of the people giving the information.
Well, it's a concern only in the sense that they're interested in having control over the opinions that they have.
Right.
And if you want to control a person's opinion, the best way to do it is to feed them just one side of the information over and over and over again. It's
like
it's the big lie technique.
It is the big lie, which was invented and popularized by Joseph Goebbels on behalf of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in Germany in the 30s.
Yeah, well, we're seeing a modern version of it here with the Fox television network Channel Radio and some others.
I was about to say, I would have liked to seen, at least on a theoretical level, what Goebbels could have done with modern technology, but actually I can look at what Roger Ailes has done and I can see it.
You can see it. It's right there. Yeah.
I don't need to imagine it.
Roger Ailes doesn't need to take any lessons from Goebbels. I
right.
think it might be the other way around.
Right. And to tell people who don't know, Roger Ailes was a big consultant for the Republican Party for a long time, and then he's now in charge of Fox News.
That's right.
Okay. So with the consolidation of the news media facilitated by the organization, the government agency that's supposed to be in charge of regulating it, namely the FCC, operating on almost exactly the same basis as Daniel Troy operates at the FDA, you end up with this kind of, and in fact, efforts that Mr. Powell just made to deregulate further the ownership rules were overturned by a court, of all things, mm-hmm. saying that's too much, too fast. People have to be able to have some competing views. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big victory and in limbo. So, which is now, I think, the decision's still, I mean, it's still pending.
What's
going to happen. So given all this that we seem to remarkably agree on, if the strategy of the Democrats is to expose things and make these points, and Michael Moore did that, and he made $60 million, or the film did, and people see it, and they, you know, they go to Michael Moore meetups or whatever they do. If most of the people, though, are watching Fox News and thinking, oh, no, another beheading, I guess we better go invade, what's a good country? France. Then will happen?
Well, we're not there yet.
Okay.
So we're still in a big fight here.
Right.
The issue of consolidation has gone on, as I said, since 1987.
Right.
And the most recent effort to increase it by the Federal Communications Commission under George H.W. Bush, which is headed up by Colin Powell's son,
right.
Has failed because the courts intervened. And the courts intervened, I think, for a number of reasons, not the least of which was the fact that we have raised that issue over and over again here in the Congress, particularly in the House here, I and others, and I've introduced legislation which will roll back the media consolidation rules of the FCC back to where they were prior to the change that occurred in 1987. Before 1987, it was generally recognized that the broadcast spectrum, the airwaves, if
right.
you will,
right.
were not owned by anyone, they were owned by the American people.
Right.
And the government regulated them on behalf of the American people.
Right, that was the Federal Communications Act 1934
That's exactly right,
that 1934. Established that principle.
That's right. Well, in 1987, the Reagan administration, FCC, changed that.
Right.
We had a provision in the FCC rules.
Talk about overturning the New Deal.
Yeah, right. If you owned a radio station back prior to 1987 and you had a political point of view, and you express that point of view, that's fine. You have certainly every right to do that. But if there were people in the community that listened to your broadcast or watched it and had a different political point of view,
right.
they would come to you and say, listen, we heard yours, now you've got to air ours, and you would have to do it.
That's the equal time doctrine.
That's the equal time doctrine. They killed that in 1987. The Reagan administration killed the equal time doctrine, or the equal access clause, as it was also called.
So Al Franken doesn't get to go on the network of the lying liars who tell lies and refute them because there's no more equal time provision.
Well, they stopped the debate.
Right.
There is no longer a political debate in America the way there used to be because all you have to do is own a radio station and you can say over broadcast over that radio station or that television station anything you want to, and you don't have to worry about airing the other point of view or
okay.
giving the opportunity for the other side to be aired.
Just a little point about how entrenched that point of view seems to be. I spent a half an hour yesterday morning arguing with the screeners at the local public radio station. They had on the Republican candidate for the United States Senate. And next month he's going to be in a debate with the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate. It's a foregone conclusion that Barbara Boxer is going to get reelected and that Bill Jones isn't. But there's a third, there's a Peace and Freedom candidate, there's also a Libertarian running who has some different ideas about getting out of Iraq, about decriminalizing marijuana, and a few other subjects. And I've made my best case over and over again to the screener saying, you know, I would like to ask the Republican candidate why he's not stepping out, why he's refusing to debate without letting the Libertarian in as well. And finally they got word back from the host or somebody that said, well, that's obvious. He doesn't want the person to get any more votes, you know? And I said, well, how about some new ideas? So it goes beyond all that. Okay, well, we're having a pretty good time attacking all these things, but let me try to ask just sort of one more time. So about what you hope to accomplish and maybe come full circle back to this press release and other efforts, you're saying that that by raising these issues as well as you can in the House and bringing them to the attention of courts, that the courts will be emboldened to stand up to this juggernaut of call it totalitarianism. Let's call it statism. And no, let's call it totalitarianism, corporate totalitarianism, and stand up. But it seems to me that if the Republican Party can send thugs down to on the congressional staff, on the congressional payroll, down to Florida to threaten the vote counters, it's not a much bigger step to send someone in the middle of, and lock up a lot of people without access to attorneys, and after 6 months of fighting or 2 years of fighting, grant them slight rights to use those attorneys, to send someone to arrest the judges. And who's going to complain if Fox News says subversive and terrorist judges were today arrested?
Well, that's why this fight is so important. It's so important because we don't want this country to get to that position. We don't want the people of America to lose the rights and freedoms that they hold so dear and cherish so rightly. We've got to maintain them and make sure that the philosophy of this administration and the way that they've carried out their responsibilities is going to be very short-lived, and it will end at the end of this year after the next election.
Do you ever worry that by speaking out like that, you're putting yourself on a list of the people they'll come for after the judges?
Oh, sure, of course.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I just do it. I mean, my responsibility is to deal with the truth here and to tell it as clearly and as accurately as I possibly can. And that gives anybody else the opportunity to argue with me and debate with me, and I welcome that. I would love to have a debate with anyone in the Bush administration on any of these issues that we have talked about here today, as well as Iraq and a host of other things.
Okay, well, the next time I get through to some of them, I'll tell them that, and maybe we can do it. Because the feeling I get here is of Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Nazi Germany and all these movies I see about Chile and Argentina and those people who were socialists or not socialists, mm-hmm. who disappeared under the totalitarian regimes that, with the United States' help, took over their countries.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And
going back to 1973 in Chile.
Exactly. And well,
72 and 73.
We got another hour and a half to talk about Henry Kissinger and whether he should be tried as a war criminal. But we won't talk about that now. But I want to thank you very much for your time and your ideas and your efforts. And hopefully, I'm going to go back to competing with Fox for the ears of the American people to listen to what you have to say, as well as what those other people have to say.
Well, thanks, Mark, and happy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, don't hang up. I'm going to cut this off, though. Okay, here we go, just a minute.